Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Shoving Wilco podcast. I am your host, Todd Rossnagel, and it is great to have you along with us. My good friend Tim Arnold joins us for this episode once again. Tim, welcome back to the pod.
Thanks, Todd. This is the day we've been working towards, isn't it? Today, for the first time, we go from talking about Wilco to actually talking with Wilco.
Let's get straight to it. We have a very special guest with us today, and chances are you saw the title of this episode, and you know exactly who I'm talking about. It is none other than John Stierrett, the talented bassist and longtime member of Wilco. What a career, spanning decades and a discography that has left an indelible mark on music scene, and for that matter, our lives. He has been an integral part of shaping the sound, the direction, and the legacy of Wilco. And as odd as it sounds, the three of us have something in common. We are all former Mandeville High School skippers. John, welcome to the Shoving Wilco podcast.
Great to be here, Todd. What an intro. And had I known you were this good on a podcast, you know, the school connection wouldn't have mattered. So it's good to be here, and you know, look forward to the chat.
And we are looking forward to it as well. So thanks again for your time. Tim and I talked at length about where to start our conversation with you. And let's just go back in time, maybe start at the very beginning when it all began. Take us back maybe to the summer of 1994, 30 years ago this year. Uncle Tupelo plays its last concert, and I guess about a month later, you're in Memphis, Tennessee, recording AM. What do you remember most about those days?
Well, what's funny is that I had already known Jeff for about 6 years at that point. We had already, you know, I'd done that last stint in Uncle Tupelo. I had I went to college up at Ole Miss, University of Mississippi, and I was in a band called the Hilltops with at the time my twin sister Laurie and Carrie Hudson, drummer named Hank Sossaman. We were hitting it really hard in terms of like the regional circuit, you know, which at that time comprised of places like the Nick in Birmingham, which is amazingly still around, WC Don's in Jackson, all the way to, you know, to Florida, the Covered Dish, Antenna Club in Memphis. It was still a really thriving sort of scene. We got a cassette at the college radio station. We were friendly with the program director there of a band called Uncle Tupelo, single cassette, picture of guitar on a guy strumming a Rickenbacker guitar. I remember that. And on the back was a phone number, 314 area code, St. Louis, called it up, and it's Tony Margarita, really taken with the music. It was all the No Depression songs, but done in a really sort of, you know how they ended up recording that at Fort Apache in Boston, and it was all really sounded like Dinosaur Jr. But this version of the record was very, very stripped down, very birdsy, a lot cleaner guitar sounds, and you know, we loved it. Like, hey, you know, we have this club down here in Oxford, a place called Sid and Harry's, our friend booked, and you want to come down, we'll open for you. And it was like the way it happened in those days, you know. We were like, sure, we'll come down. They crashed with us in Oxford. And, of course, it was like 2 or 3 days until their next gig. So it's like, oh, how long are you staying? Is it, oh, it's like, oh, you're going to hang for 3 days? Okay, that's fine. But we became friendly that way, and they took us on the road later on. We did a Chicago gig opening for them, St. Louis gig. So sort of flash forward to 94. They had asked me to come along on their first European tour in 92.
As their bass player?
As a guitar tech, actually. It was like Brian Henneman of the Bottle Rockets had that job. Mm-hmm. And it was like my first trip to Europe. I'm like, absolutely. I don't really care if I'm playing or tuning or whatever. So ended up doing that, and invited to Belleville to get ready for their next record. And I assumed I would sort of be roadieing again, but showed up and they just handed me a guitar. And they were, that's kind of the pivotal point in the story, because they, that last tour of Anodyne, when everything fell apart, last Mississippi Nights gigs we did with them. And then the recording for AM, it was like, yeah, literally a month apart. It was crazy. Like Jeff had these tunes. He wanted to continue it, hit the ground running. And that's sort of where we started out.
Would you say that AM is the songs Jeff was writing for the next Tupelo record that just didn't happen?
Probably. I think in that frame of mind, it was, you know, he was, you know, they were both writing constantly, and I'm sure he assumed it would be Uncle Tupelo, I would say that that's correct. We hadn't really, we'd run maybe a couple of them on the road in preparation for that, but of course the band didn't really survive that tour, and much longer after that.
John, was there a moment in some of those early days when you said to yourself, this is going to work? Maybe a defining moment that sort of solidified the band's identity and direction?
It really wasn't until being there, the main recording session in Chicago for Being There, and I can almost remember the exact, it sounds corny, but I do remember the last tracking Sunken Treasure live, and sort of having the last note ring out and saying, okay, well, that's new territory. That's this actually might work. Nothing against AM, but it was so. And AM was effortless as well. I mean, it had an effortless quality to it. The first time we ever rolled tape was track one, I Must Be High. That was take one of any Wilco track in the studio. We didn't, you know, no demo, no, that was it. And so this could have legs, you know. What you always wanted to do, and now you got it, and I must be high to say goodbye. About that band.
I talk extensively about the moment for me when I sort of leaned forward in my chair was the song Misunderstood. And take me kind of back into the recording of that song, because that, along with Sunken Treasure, was just completely new territory. And to open up the album in that way was just, I mean, it was different. It was a new direction for Wilco.
We were already sort of having these experimental leanings and sort of this idea of approaching this song that was it was like sort of the real take the guitar player for a ride, and it was basically there's a line from a guy named Peter Lofner who was a great musician, music writer, and take the guitar player for a ride, he's never once been satisfied. I remember us having the idea of just, well, let's switch instruments. You know, this is essentially a two chord song. Let's switch instruments on this and see what happens. The guitar player for a ride. You know, the yin to sort of experiment was already there, and we really did have great luck doing it from the beginning. I guess, you know, it's easy maybe it's easy if the tunes are there, it's easy if you haven't done this before, but we essentially made a noise track of us playing. I was playing violin, right? I forget who played what, but all that noise, and then we did a conventional version of it and crossfaded it together, and wow. It just happened, you know. It was one of those things that's like, wow, this was exciting. It sort of set the tone for that record and beyond, especially, I guess, especially beyond, because the aspects of being there are pretty conventional, you know. You might just crawl back in bed. The
fortune inside your head. Yeah, you mentioned Peter Lofner, and I got to tell you, as thorough as I've sort of been on loving this band and diving in head first, I'd never heard of Lofner and that song Amphetamine that the lyrics came from until just the other day. And I shared it with Todd. So it's funny that you brought it up right off the top. You know, influences are kind of an onion that unravel like that. And that's one of the things I was most excited to talk to you about, your personal influences. You know, what were those kind of core childhood bands and songs that shaped you, shaped your sound, your playing, drove you into it? And as you're getting into this sort of, you know, you're not just doing three verses and a bridge, you know, like when you're making unique music like Wilco does, where does all this come from?
It's like every album and every song is like a weird different story, you know. It's just so, mm-hmm. you're sort of just meeting what the subject matter in just a different way. It's kind of a different story every time, and very often a different approach. And you know, Jeff has always been great about keeping that fresh and with, you know, different ways, like in Ghost Is Born era, doing really these like detailed exercises in random accidents, basically. Up your mind with all you can know. Don't forget that your body can let it all go. Finding inspiration from that or editing from that. What would we be
without wishful thinking? Yeah, his songwriting definitely takes the sort of center stage for Wilco, but it's just known as a band of six musical geniuses. And to me, I love Jeff's solo stuff. I love Autumn Defense. I love Nell's solo stuff. Glenn's Mobile album is in repeat and everything. But to me, it's how Wilco comes together, this sort of synthesis. You know, maybe Jeff is the Brian Wilson in the group, but talk a little bit about how you guys create music together, you know, like you're talking about this experimental and who brings what to the table?
Well, it's different story almost every record. Certainly the people involved, that's a huge, you know, I mean, we've recorded, I mean, the Leroy Bach era, you know, we had Bob Egan playing guitar on, going back to Mermaid Avenue and thinking about how that process went down. So it's been this like different, you know, and granted the, what I guess is really a definitive lineup now is these guys right now, like 20 years of that and that process and that, you know, thinking about Sky Blue Sky or Whole Love. And that's some of the most sort of detailed, intense sort of collaboration that we, you know, and starts off sort of, you know, Jeff's drumming Art of Almost, for example, a grooving kind of, there's a version that we did in Iceland. We've done it a couple of times recently, the original version of that. You know, that's just the way the song sort of existed. No,
arms, I can't be so far away from my wasteland.
Yeah, hearing the album version, you wouldn't expect that to start as an acoustic strummer.
Right. You know, so there's all elements of deconstruction going on over time. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, for example. Other mm-hmm. times where it's just much more of a conventional, we had Hear What Jeff Has, hammer out an arrangement on the floor. Or maybe it's already pretty fully arranged. No, it's just all over the place. You're being led by this light at the end of the tunnel, and this, it's not easy to just encapsulate in one sort of way.
It would be almost impossible to define it, because then it wouldn't really be a spiritual thing, right? I mean, if you could figure it out in nice little neat lines and boxes, then it kind of stops being the thing that it is. Tim has always talked about on this podcast that Wilco songs kind of seem, at least to us as we hear them, kind of like a bag of ice. What do you do with a bag of ice when you first get it? You throw it on the ground, break it up, and maybe that's what you do with songs. Do you think that there's some of that element to it?
At times, absolutely, and that's a nice analogy. It's some of the most successful moments we've had in the studio have been about that, being there and misunderstood, essentially, that, like, this sort of trying to go back into a song in an unconventional way. And certainly the process of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, and what, spending 2 to 6 versions of every song in that record to try to find some kind of pathway or sort of eureka moment, only to have sort of Jim O'Rourke, objectivity completely lost at that point. Jim taking it and then creating "I'm Trying to Break Your Heart," and like, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's that. Yeah. So.
I am trying to break your heart.
Well, it's sort of like that Sgt. Pepper studio as an instrument kind of concept, right?
Yeah. He has an amazing process. He was just his records that he made on Drag City were all this. At the time, we were very, really into what he was doing. It was this really sort of, episodic, cinematic mixing style. And it mm-hmm. kind of centered around that sort of John Fahey rolling acoustic guitar, and going into these incredible movements, and it was very, very, very heady, and to see how he actually, sort of take us in that direction in a certain way, to see how he did it. The medium of what we were working with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot at that point, which was half analog, half digital, kind of he sort of brought it all, did these mixes straight to 2-track analog, that were sort of, and then would cut that tape and create the song out of it. So it was really interesting process and also impossible to reproduce,
Right.
Yeah.
That's the whole Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Go in and, we want more vocal on this song. Like, sorry, it's done. There is no, there is no going back. It's a performance-based mix, essentially. So, there's there's no changing anything. That made it really easy, in that period to stick by the record. It was like, how would we go in and do this again? And after what we had been through at that point, it's like, why? We had already been recording for what seemed like years. So. But yeah, it's certainly that the deconstructive element is, or a experimental element is just treated as well. And but I would say more than is, you know, probably more time in Wilco on certain tracks have been spent in a really conventional sitting in a circle kind of way, or with Jeff having a pretty, you know, having a finished song and just hammering out parts, you know.
And I think you can feel the ebb and flow of it, you know. Like Cruel Country was kind of returning back to this, like you said, six guys in a room playing music. And then Cousin just comes right back out, much more experimental, like some of these earlier records we're talking about.
Yeah, just, you know, just building, you know, you can definitely tell it's building, and as opposed to, you can definitely feel the sort of whatever, the sixth, seventh person in the room, the sort of studio, this ambiance that is like six guys playing in a room together. And that Cruel Country was really, really rewarding in that way. You know, we did that really, really fast in a way that was sort of had similar feelings to being there. I had there were a lot of parallels to being there for me.
Well, John, let's move to Wilco Live. As Wilco fans know all too well, Wilco Live is very much a thing. The live shows are just so incredible on so many levels.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you. I think you would agree with me that they are, in some ways, a bit cosmic in nature. And what I mean by that is there's this connection between the band and the audience, and it kind of transcends the moment. These songs suddenly become more than just music. They're these shared experiences, a moment of communion, if you will, between the artist and listener. And that's probably a little over the top, but I bet you would agree with me.
I'm just trying not to clam, basically. No, I'm sorry. That's very kind, and it's a beautiful description. And I do feel that. I do feel that at times, you know, certainly the exchange of the fan energy and band, you know, it's absolutely so special, and so much gratitude for that. And, you know,
well, and it's probably hard for you to speak to it. You'd probably have to talk about another band that you had seen on the audience side.
Yeah. Oh, I do have these, you know, feelings. It's funny, you know, there is a certain thing with the passion of Wilco fans, you know. So we were looking at, you know, you mentioned 94 and what was going on musically then, and it was so many great records came out in 94, you know, and that was those were the seminal years for me. But I mean, you're talking about, you know, Crooked Rain, I mean, B-1000, but, you know, Guided by Voices. I mean, what, you know, so in a way, I was never a massive Dead fan either. So I didn't have this, I don't know if I ever had this communal sort of thing with a band. I'm trying to think. Well, I guess maybe REM to some extent. Yeah, that would probably be the closest. Seeing REM, not even all that early, like 86, 87. So much of what I was seeing in my early days was, it wasn't theater music either. It was all clubs. I never really had this theatrical communal experience with a band like that. I was seeing like Beck, you know, on play Loser at Memphis in May, you know, and like just ham-fisting his way through that, or, you know, or Weezer on the first tour, it was just, it was still full on rock. And that was, you know, underground rock, alternative rock. And that was, so in a way it really did. I didn't really have that kind of experience.
It's like the Wizard of Oz, though. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. But in some ways, you are the guy behind the curtain. You know, like, you know how the sausage is made and all that stuff. You're up there playing it while we're receiving the communal.
And giving it back. I mean, that's the main, you know, it wouldn't, I've always felt like really from the beginning, seeing the Wilco fan base, like, sort of become like structured and almost like organized. Like, I remember seeing early online forums when I was still rocking dial up, you know, completely on the, you know, and I don't, how would someone find out how to find this place and talk about us? And you know, it's something, you know, and you know, there was this like, well, I knew there were some early kind of Bay Area fans, you know, and I think they like set the tone, and Ken Wagner, our original webmaster, who mm-hmm. really helped, you know, facilitate streaming Yankee Hotel Foxtrot for the first time.
But it is a culture thing that you guys have embraced. I mean, I remember I saw you guys at the John Anson Ford Amphitheater, 2001, I think, and just a kid with a mini disc recorder in my pocket, and Stan Doty let me patch in. And that was my first live Wilco recording.
Do you remember the deer? There was a deer behind the, that was crazy. It's the only time you've ever had a deer on stage, you know, in all these years.
But that's amazing. It's this little nestled in the hills. Yeah.
But we did have, kind of what I was getting at with the fans. They just sort of organized themselves in this way, and had this community that I always like kind of felt that, you know, the band, it was almost superfluous or something, you know, the band was almost, it was like, you know, they loved us and everything, but it's like their community was like really strong. I don't know if I put too much, I don't know, into that, but, you know,
no, they always, it's still they strong.
Always, it is. And they've always felt like, look, this is kind of our thing too. We're going to talk about it. And I'm like, no, actually this is what happened. And they're like, they shut the fuck up. Just, you know, that's what happened. It's like, you know, it's like, I literally have been like, you know, I don't even argue with certain Wilco people about what went down. That's not entirely true, but yeah, it is this kind of special thing. And it's, God, has it gone on for so long? It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, John, maybe you don't want to go here, but giving us a sneak peek behind the curtain, if you will, I've always wanted to ask someone in the band about the construction of set lists. What is that process like, and what goes into it?
Well, I have to give Jeff credit on this. He is a pretty darn good master of ceremonies in that he organizes the set list and sort of does it every day. We definitely work on it collectively, or at least approve, but we find these sort of blocks in tour to tour that sort of work together, and they're just kind of amorphous, you know. They get certain ones, of course, these sort of songs that work together, or the blocks of three or four songs. It revolves around the latest record, what we have. We're always going to play seven, eight songs on the new record. Then new and old songs sort of come in and out, and they always have what seem like little companion pieces. These are songs that kind of work together, and then they also negate other songs that may be very similar to those songs, you know. So then it's like you understand that songs sort of take a rest, but you know, by the time, certainly Whole Love, the repertoire was so big, there's a lot at play, but there's also, you know, a lot of our fans, I do want to say that, you know, people would like more of like a Fish experience with a really unique set list every show. But we definitely understand that. On the other hand, you know, we're still a one-nighter theater band. We do residencies occasionally, but generally we're pulling into Lansing, Michigan, playing or and how deep, how, you know, I mean,
yeah, I get
how many
that.
People want to hear mega deep cuts, you know? I mean, we just have a lot of people that follow the band from place to place. We see both sides of it, but it is a little bit hard not playing certain songs in a place we haven't played for 4 or 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it just seems tough.
But even still, I'm looking at the tour coming up. You guys are heading off to Japan and Australia, a couple of good places before the Solid Sound. And you can even every single one of these dates, you can drop down menu, request a song. And I mean, Barnyard Pimp is on this. A lot of great covers. You know, I could get
hilarious.
Just about anything played, you know?
Oh my God. Oh, so you scroll down the whole catalog basically. Scrolls down when you.
Yeah.
Oh my God,
everything.
It's amazing.
I don't even
That's
know what
incredible.
Dark California Stars is, but that must be interesting.
That was. Did you see any of the Americanorama shows by chance?
Yeah.
On that.
Nashville. You guys played Birdsong right into Tomorrow Never Knows.
Tomorrow Never Knows.
Amazing.
Well, Dark California Stars was Dark Star California Stars. Sorry, Dark Star into California Stars into Dark Star again, or out into Dark Star, which we did. Bob Weir was. On the tour, woodshedding with us daily, pretty much. I mean, that was like a band camp experience. We were learning, you know, we had so many guests on that. We spent most of the days just, you know, I can't believe we, you know, had Nancy Sinatra in our dressing room and fucking worked up some songs with it. That was insane. It was amazing. One of my fondest memories of that tour was Bob Weir coming in painstakingly learning St. Stephen's, and which we were going to do at Shoreline Amphitheater. And as we're sound checking it, one of the old crusty dead roadies, crew guys, you know, just house guy. It's like, oh, you're going to do that here, huh? You're going to do that in Jerry's house? And we're like, oh, yeah, okay, let's go run it a little more in the dressing room. So Bob comes in, runs it with us. We get out on stage, play a couple of songs. Bob's coming up on the third song. We're going to do it. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Weir.
Mr. Bob Weir.
Comes out, you know, and he brings his amp. It's all of a sudden there's like dead space on, and then so like, you know, smattering. It's like applause has long since died out, and he's finally ready to go. He turns to us and says, "What are we doing?" We're like, "Oh yeah, you were in the Grateful Dead. That's right."
Right.
No, it's like the thing we just ran in the dressing room for like 2 hours.
Love that. Well, on the flip side of it, that night in Nashville, you guys came out playing Birdsong, and Bob was like upset that it was too fast, and he's like slowed everything down. Slow it down.
That's my memory of him on that tour, was him just pushing his hand down, you know, it's just like we were scoping YouTube, like, do we, you know, are we doing this? Is St. Stephen's, is it like the Playboy After Dark version of St. Stephen's on YouTube, or which one is it, you know? And but we could pretty much guarantee everything, whatever Bob wanted to play in 2014 or whenever that was half the speed of what it normally was.
It can't be one or the other for sure, but talk a little bit about, you know, playing in front of a live audience and that experience of performing, but the act of creation, you know, going into the studio with your guys and breaking bags of ice on new song. What do you love as a musician? You love performance? Do you love creation?
Well, I mean, I think we're from the tradition of this symbiotic quality between those two things, and needing one as much as the other. Certainly we've kind of moved on from this sort of like, right when we quit, right when we stop touring, we're back in the studio. We get the next, product, or whatever. But mm-hmm. those two things are, they absolutely complement each other. I will say that I enjoy the studio process the older I get, much mm-hmm. more than the live thing. Just only in the touring is just hard.
I know Todd's dying to go back and ask you something from the AM conversation we had.
Oh, Todd. Absolutely.
I do have a question about AM. Who was on the passenger side? Who almost spilled?
Who was the driver?
Yeah. Who almost spilled Jeff's beer?
I think of Jeff as being that person, not being the narrator. That's the way I've always felt. For the last couple of miles, you've been swerving from side to side.
You're gonna make me spill my beer. Because Jeff's the guy driving everybody else around.
Well, no, exactly. I thought of him as that guy, and just kind of knowing him. I remember the car he had. I'm trying to remember the actual make. I want to say it was like a 94 Celica or something in Chicago when he first moved there. And literally the right hand side of the car was caved in. It was crazy. I don't know how it drove. It was like something you definitely see on the road in Chicago quite a bit, cars of that nature. I remember that him having that song right around that time and sort of deducing of, wow, okay, that's where that came from. It's like this, when you say that word passenger side too many enough times, it's like, oh, good song title.
Yeah. And one of the lines is, I don't like riding on the passenger side, considering the condition of the car.
Exactly. That may have been true. Thank you.
I got one that I've always wanted to ask. On Summer Teeth, on Always in Love, are you really singing Smoke Pot in the harmonies? And also, it sounds like, is that through a Leslie?
We did. We those background vocals were put, we were singing, yeah, we did a round of, say, Smoke Pot. And then half of the tracks we reversed, like using really, like, OS 8, like early Pro Tools 1, because Summer Teeth, that was the story of that record, was how it was incredibly early Pro Tools, and how that sort of going from Pro Tools to analog, it created the sound of that record. It was this weird latency between things, and there's a lot of bouncing back and forth. But that background vocal was Smoke Pot, and then that signal actually done backwards, maybe like three or four of the vocals like done backwards, so it's like, you know, it's like pot smoke and just like the slurry kind of sounding.
And now you have to sing that live in concert.
It's true. Yeah. You always have to think, had I known that we would still be playing this, 26 years later or something, and we might have made a different call on that.
Yeah.
What's next with you, John? We haven't had an Autumn Defense record in 10 years.
Well, it's funny you should ask. Because really? I'm going to Nashville on Friday to record an Autumn Defense record.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's been a long time. We recorded a few tracks and it's already been a year and a half ago, something like that. But we're sort of chipping away. And then Wilco had such a big year last year. We just weren't able to complete it. I am headed to Nashville and we are going to finish a record, in February, hopefully to come out later in the year. So, really excited about it.
Fantastic.
Obviously Patrick Sansone, James Haggerty on bass and Greg Wazorik, G Wiz on drums. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's like not only, I don't know, I'd like to play with Wilco and to have these guys you played with for 30 years, but then Autumn Defense is like, I mean, it started in 99, you know, you started playing with G Wiz in 1999 and then Pat joins Wilco in 2004. And so Autumn Defense has always been this kind of like cousin, you know, I use the word cousin. It's always been this sort of, the people have always been in the orbit of Wilco. We've done so many Between Solid Sound and, you know, Sky Blue Sky, you know, the guys are like kind of weirdly in the family and it's in this kind of cool way. So I'm excited about it.
John, this has just been absolutely fantastic. We cannot thank you enough for carving time out of your I know, a very busy schedule, especially when you're getting ready to record a new album. You got a lot on your plate, and thank you for making the time to join us here on the podcast. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening all these years. It's great to be here, and best of luck as the podcast continues to grow.
Once again, we thank John for his time, and we thank you for your time. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Shoving Wilco podcast. If you have an idea for an episode, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is shovingwilco@gmail.com. That contact information is also found in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and have a great day, everyone. Wilco will love you, baby.